Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Yesterday was the day former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn expected to be sentenced for lying to the FBI. Flynn and his supporters had hoped he wouldn't receive jail time. What happened surprised everyone. D.C. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan spent a full 8 minutes reading out loud a list of Flynn's lies and asking Flynn to affirm again and again that he knew lying to the FBI was wrong. Flynn's future still hangs in the balance. The judge delayed sentencing until March, saying, quote, "I can't promise you a sentence that involves no jail time." This hour on Point, we'll take a look at how we got to here, Michael Flynn's career, his future, and what it means for the Mueller investigation. And you can join us. What do you make of the judge's fiery grilling of the former National Security Advisor? What's your question for two journalists who've long been following Flynn's career, from Lieutenant General to the White House to admitted felon? And a little later this hour, we'll speak with the president of the NAACP about how Russia targeted African Americans in its social media disinformation campaign. But first, let's go to Washington, where Nicholas Schmidl joins us. He's staff writer at The New Yorker, and he was in the courthouse yesterday during Flynn's sentencing hearing. Nicholas Schmidl, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on.
Also with us from Washington is Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post. Mark, great to have you as well.
Hello, Meghna.
And by the way, you can find links to both Mark and Nicholas's extensive reporting on Michael Flynn at our website, onpointradio.org. So, Nicholas, let me start with you since you were in the courthouse yesterday. As Judge Sullivan was, you know, reading, for example, that 8-minute long list of Flynn's lies, I mean, what was the mood in the courtroom? What was the reaction of people in there?
Well, you know, the judge admitted to being somewhat puzzled at the outset of the session, in the sense that Flynn had pled guilty, and yet a week ago his lawyers had responded to the special counsel office's sentencing memo by raising all sorts, sort of casting aspersions on the process by which the terms under which Flynn's crimes took place, saying that Flynn didn't know that lying to FBI agents was a crime, mm-hmm. and suggesting that the FBI suggesting that the misconduct of the FBI agents who interviewed him wasn't known at the time. So it was actually. It was sort of herky-jerky in the sense that it was unclear where the judge was going with his line of questioning and where the possible outcome of the hearing was going to be. So when he started going through the sort of the litany of Flynn's transgressions, it was stark. And the judge had a tendency to speak very casually. He on several occasions made comments of, you know, I probably shouldn't be saying this, but went ahead and said it anyways, kind of casual, almost imprecision in his speech. So when he started then very, very dramatically, you know, referring to how Flynn had sort of gone against everything that the flag stood for. Yeah, it was a very stark moment.
Right. And in fact, for some of the things that the judge said, Michael Flynn's lawyers pushed back on as well. We should note that. But Mark Fisher, many of Flynn's supporters and perhaps Flynn's own legal team had hoped that in Judge Sullivan they might find someone who has historically been a judge that's held prosecutors to a very high standard and looked very carefully at prosecutorial misconduct, and perhaps they were hoping that the judge would speak about the Mueller investigation. But instead, what we got was Judge Sullivan repeatedly asking Michael Flynn to affirm that he knew that lying to the FBI was wrong. I mean, how significant was that?
Well, it was very significant, especially given the kind of foundation of support that Michael Flynn has around the country among hardcore Trump supporters who see Michael Flynn as someone – as a hero, as someone who's standing tall for the president. And to a lot of those folks, they've held rallies for him. They've started a legal defense fund. There's a group calling itself the Deplorable Choir that put out a country tune honoring General Flynn. So for all of those people, this was quite a shocking moment to have General Flynn, whose family and friends have in recent months been saying that he has been railroaded, that FBI agents acted improperly in kind of tricking him into pleading guilty, and that he'd only really decided to plead guilty because he wanted to stop the bleeding, both financially and emotionally, of being under investigation. Well, for all of those folks, here was repeatedly this moment where General Flynn said, yes, I knew what I did was wrong. Yes, I knew that lying was a crime. I didn't need to be reminded of this by FBI agents. I'm here honestly and willfully. This morning, there are a lot of Flynn supporters who are saying, well, maybe we were wrong, or at least asking that question.
Yeah. So let's go to how the White House responded following this really unexpected outcome to the sentencing hearing yesterday. Here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders. She held a press conference shortly after the hearing, and a reporter asked her whether the White House was willing to walk back its accusations that the FBI, quote, ambushed Michael Flynn, now that Flynn, as we've been talking about, had admitted in court that he knew that lying to the FBI was a crime. Sarah Sanders, however, stuck to the White House line on the ambush claim.
What we do know that was inappropriate by own self-admittance of James Comey is that the FBI broke standard protocol in the way that they came in and ambushed General Flynn, and in the way that they questioned him, and in the way that they encouraged him not to have White House counsel's office present. And we know that because James Comey told us that, and he said that the very reason that they did it was because it was the Trump administration and they thought they could get away with it.
That's Sarah Sanders, the White House press secretary yesterday. Nicholas Schmidl, so they're sticking to this line regardless of what Flynn said in court yesterday. But remind us, what is Sarah Sanders referring to here about what James Comey said?
Yeah, so on January 24th, 2017, a pair of FBI agents showed up at the White House and asked to speak to Flynn. I'm not sure the exchange as to what they initially told him they needed to speak about, whether there was a knock at the door, the circumstances surrounding this sort of the early engagement are unclear, but. Mm-hmm. But it was around or pertaining to Flynn's phone call with the Russian ambassador. And so it's very hard to sort of make any sense of what Sarah Sanders is saying in the sense, Flynn had worked very, very closely with FBI agents during his military career. This is sort of part of what made actually what was the sort of signature of what he brought to the special operations community, which was infiltrate sort of using FBI agents on the ground alongside of special operators to have a kind of forensic approach to doing these nightly raids against al-Qaeda targets. So Flynn had very long time sort of cooperation and appreciation and understanding of how FBI agents operate and work. So the notion that he was, ambushed or surprised or whatever is bit rubbish.
So Mark Fisher, then what do you hear in terms of the White House really sticking to this line here? Is that a sign to you that that perhaps there's an increasing amount of anxiety about, first of all, we know that Michael Flynn spoke to the Mueller team, 19 times. We don't know what he said. And now we still have this maybe a 3-month period before we know what Flynn is going to be sentenced to. So is there, what's the tenor of the White House now?
Well, I think Michael Flynn remains something of a wild card for the president and his defenders. On the one hand, Flynn has been extremely loyal to the administration. Flynn's family and friends, acting as his surrogates, have been traveling the country and active on social media, rallying support to him and very much portraying Flynn as an ally of the president. So the president, in turn, has been supportive in his tweets of Michael Flynn. On the other hand, Flynn made it clear in court yesterday that he gave those 19 interviews to Mueller's attorneys, prosecutors, and more than 60 hours of testimony. Mm. And everyone on all sides said he was being extremely forthcoming and extremely helpful. The prosecutors bent over backwards to say they didn't think he deserved much in the way of jail time because he'd been so helpful in their investigation. So obviously, for the president, this raises some questions about what did Flynn Flynn tell them? What was he in a position to know? And so there's some nervousness there. But I think primarily what we're hearing from the White House is the basic core Trump notion of doubling down and distraction and trying to continue to portray Flynn as an ally, perhaps as a way of sending a signal about a possible pardon down the line.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick call here. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Manchester, Maryland. Mike, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you. Hi. My comment is a simple one. I think Michael Flynn, he's a former general, and I'd like you to take a look at what he's done by lying to the FBI, by lying and representing the Turks who are not our friends. They represent both the Russians as well as America. They look for what's best for their interests. Michael Flynn is supposed to be a leader, an example for foot soldiers and for men and women that serve in the armed forces. And for him to lie to the FBI and for him to represent the Turks, all for the sake of money, is despicable. This judge has got it right. This guy should be tried for treason. He should be made an example of, and he should be put in jail. The problem we have in America is men and women that are in leadership positions are behaving despicable. And Michael Flynn is a representative example, and the judge is dead on. This guy needs to be made an example of. Right. It's not Republican. It's not Democrat. It's how he's perceived. He's a general, and we have to keep that in perspective. Generals should not be lying to the FBI. He should be tried on treason. He should be put in jail.
Hey, Mike, can I just jump in here for a second? I have a quick question for you. Did you serve in the military or have any members of your family who were in the military?
I will not comment on my military background. I will say this. I think it's terrible that guys like this get into leadership positions, and he's done this throughout his career. Mm. And this is a problem. He represents the armed forces of America, and right. He is supposed to be someone we look up to and say, look at that guy. He's upstanding. He represents the best of America.
Yeah.
He should not be lying. He should not be lying to the FBI. The FBI serves the people of America. And I think it's terrible.
I'm going to take it back from you there, and I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's just that we have 30 seconds to go here before the break, but you can hear in Mike from Maryland his passion around what Michael Flynn's service in the United States military means to him and the example that ought to have set for how Flynn led his life, and that it's in opposition to where he finds himself now. So we're going to pick it up there and look back at Flynn's career when we come back here in just a moment. We're talking about Michael Flynn, the sentencing hearing that happened yesterday, and what's next. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the surprise outcome of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's sentencing hearing yesterday. And we're also going to take a look back at Flynn's career and how we got to this point. I'm joined today by Nicholas Schmidl. He's staff writer at The New Yorker. He was at the courthouse in Washington for yesterday's hearing. Mark Fisher is also with us. He's a senior editor at The Washington Post. They've both been reporting extensively on Flynn for some time, and we have links to all of their great stories at onpointradio.org. I just want to travel back in time a little bit here and go to the summer of 2016 when General Michael Flynn spoke at the Republican National Convention, where he famously led the charge, this particular charge, against Democratic
candidate, Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton.
We do not need a reckless president who believes she is above the law. Lock her up. That's right. Lock her up.
That was Michael Flynn, summer of 2016. Fast forward to just yesterday, and here's what it sounded like outside the Washington Federal Courthouse as Flynn left the sentencing hearing. Protesters chanting, "Lock him up." You'll hear counter-protesters chanting, "USA."
Lock him up!
So that was just yesterday at the Washington Courthouse here. Nicholas Schmidl and Mark Fisher, I'm very glad that you both were able to join us today because I've been so impressed with the deep reporting that you've done about Flynn's career and spoken to, you know, both him last year and people very close to him. So Mark Fisher, let me just start with you here. Take us back. I mean, how far back in Flynn's career do we need to go, his time in the military, as lieutenant general, as head of the Defense Intelligence Agency? I mean, how far back do we need to go to see, is there a point in which, you know, his path sort of bifurcates to in the direction that he ended up now?
As divided as people are about Michael Flynn, as you just heard in those different chants, there's one thing that unifies everyone who knows him, and that is that something changed, something turned in Michael Flynn. Now, there are some people who say he may have harbored these views going way back, but he was at least conforming to the military tradition of nonpartisanship during a very storied 33-year career in the Army. But at some point over the last few years, beginning while he was at the Defense Intelligence Agency, which he was director of under President Obama, he began to spout these odd ideas. People at the agency called them Flynn facts, and they were the kinds of things that you would get from Breitbart or Alex Jones. They were fringy notions about American power. They were extreme denunciations of Islam. They were embraces of Pizzagate, the notion that Hillary Clinton ran a sex ring in the basement of a Northwest Washington pizza parlor. He was picking some of this up from his son, Michael Jr. And some people say that Flynn turned when he was fired by Obama's top people, removed from the DIA. So he's lost his career. His mother died around the same time. He's reuniting with his son, who's quite extreme in his own social media presentation. And somehow Michael Flynn, this reasonably measured, conforming military officer, becomes kind of a wild-eyed extremist.
Right. Well, so and he was fired by Obama from the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2014, right? But Nicholas Schmidl, I mean, I was reading back from your terrific 2017 piece in The New Yorker about General Flynn, and you know, you quote several former members of the military close to him who, you know, called him one of the finest leaders the Army has ever produced. And yet at the same time, he also showed, I don't know, do you call it an independent streak or a willingness to go rogue? You know, I mean, he published reports over the heads of his superiors.
Right. No, so I agree with Mark about the notion that there was an embrace of sort of partisanship at a certain point after he left the military or sort of towards the end maybe even of his tenure at the Defense Intelligence Agency. But where I would disagree a little bit is that the notion that he was conforming, he sort of prided himself on being a sort of nonconformist and being an iconoclast. And that iconoclasm dates back to about the 2004 time period when he was the intelligence director for the Joint Special Operations Command, the sort of elite terrorism hunters JSOC unit, one of which, you know, one of their units is SEAL Team 6 that eventually tracked down and killed Osama bin Laden. So this was, you know, Flynn's approach to kind of counterterrorism raids was very out of the box, and that defined both kind of at a tactical level as well as at a strategic level, sort of defined who he was, how he saw himself. And so later, as he leaves government, yes, there's an embrace of partisanship. There's an embrace of conspiracy theories. But I sort of think that it's almost a little bit more of a gradual trajectory, and this notion that iconoclasm then sort of consumed and became everything that he was, and so there he lost all boundaries so it was in many ways a very natural fit when he was introduced to Donald Trump.
And Mark Fisher, what do you say to that?
Well, I think that's right. I think what I meant by conforming is what he did in terms of his nonpartisanship. Uh-huh. So he was in the military tradition, one who avoided any partisan alliances. And in fact, he worked for administrations both Democratic and Republican. He was a registered Democrat for most of his life. His family was Democratic, and there he is embracing Donald Trump. So what really surprised and disappointed a lot of his superiors and colleagues in the post-military career of Michael Flynn was this idea that he had gone partisan and thereby undermined the credibility of the military. Flynn pushed back at this, and he said that you're not supposed to stop serving when you get out of the military. And he told us at one point, he said, does that mean that you stop being an American? No. So he felt that he had an absolute obligation to go out there and sound the warning bell about what he saw as the country going off the rails.
Yeah. And so this drive to sound the warning bell. Nicholas Schmidl, I want to reference something specifically that you wrote again last year, which was quite eye-opening, that this is something that he had done, that Flynn had done before, right? Because in, 2009, regarding Afghanistan, Flynn, I'm looking at your report now here, that he had dispatched a Marine Corps lieutenant to travel around Afghanistan to really find out what the intelligence needs were. Mm-hmm. And he put together, as you report, a very damning report about those needs not being met. But he couldn't get that report published. And then he did something interesting. He went over the heads of his superiors. Can you tell us what happened there?
Right. So and in fact, the Marine lieutenant who did the reporting and legwork for that report is now in the National Security Council by the name of Matt Pottinger, who is a China expert and who is advising President Trump on North Korea and China and Asia matters more broadly. So after they came up with this report, Flynn sort of sent it up the chain of command, didn't hear anything in reply, and reached out through contacts that Matt Pottinger had to someone at the Center for New American Security, a sort of left-leaning, centrist left-leaning Washington, D.C. think tank. And they published the report. And in many ways, it sort of further established for the non-military world Flynn's bona fides credibility as this iconoclast, this sort of out-of-the-box thinker. Not only I think many people didn't know at that time the nature of which the product was put out, but the conclusions itself were in some ways a sort of slap in the face to everything that military intelligence to the military intelligence broader conventional community, if you will.
Right. So on the one hand, as you report, then Defense Secretary Robert Gates said that the report may have actually saved them. But on the other hand, it shows a willingness to disregard the chain of command here and perhaps in terms of military culture, put himself above the law. So – and I'm seeking out patterns here.
Yeah.
Because trying to understand, how this person that, again, both of you have spoken to, folks who know Michael Flynn very well, said that, he's amongst the best the Army has ever produced. Now he's facing jail time and a judge who yesterday even asked, are you sure this is not treason?
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So a couple of things. Yes. He went around the chain of command in some way here with the publication of that report. His reply is that he sent it, he didn't hear anything back, and he sort of took the lack of feedback as someone telling him no one standing in the way of his publishing the report, which was a very sort of a gracious interpretation. By the same token, when I was asking people around the time – so my piece in the New Yorker, the profile of Flynn, came out 4 days after Flynn resigned. And one of the questions that remains is whom was Flynn taking directions from in his contacts with the Russian ambassador? And a senior military intelligence official told me at the time, and I come back to this quote over and over, which is that, you know, Mike Flynn is a soldier. He wasn't acting. He didn't go rogue. And so there, while there were roguish elements in there, it seems unlikely that in Michael Flynn's contacts with the Russians that he was doing this all as, in a freelance capacity. And just to kind of to come back full circle, that I would suspect or may be part of the reason that we see this anxiety coming from the White House.
Yeah. Mark Fisher, jump in here. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it's important to note that that paper that he wrote was called Fixing Intel. This is back in 2010. Although he kind of went outside the chain of command to get it published, what it said was actually embraced by much of the country's leadership. This idea that the nation's intelligence work in Afghanistan was incurious and disengaged and a huge waste of resources. And so that actually got him his next couple of promotions because he was seen as someone who was candid and who was critical in a way that was needed at that point. So that aspect of Flynn's personality has always been both hurtful and helpful to him.
Yeah.
And we see that dichotomy all the way through his actions in the Trump campaign.
Yeah. And so – but then we also – that same sort of willingness to buck authority comes where he's at the Defense Intelligence Agency and makes a trip to speak in Russia against the advice of, you know, fellow high-ranking members at the DIA. And then also, you know, as we now know, he was serving as a paid but unregistered agent for the Turkish government as well. So, look, I'm running out of time here, Mark and Nicholas. So hang on here for a second because I want to let at least a couple of more listeners in. So let's go to Kathleen first, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's a great segment. I would like to applaud the gentleman who spoke previous to going on break, who was celebrating the vociferousness of the judge in grinding on him about did you not know that you were in fact lying to the FBI, and the fact that this so-called gentleman is of one of the highest ranking officers. He's supposed to be the epitome of example of ideals to live up to for our youth and the country. And and the fact that we are living in a time when other people who are whistleblowers who tell the truth are being imprisoned for being terrorists and so forth, this man is definitely should be imprisoned and punished for being a traitor maybe he may even be a sociopath for all we know.
Well, Kathleen, let me take it back from you and thank you so much for your call. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Let's get one more call in here while we can. Dolores is calling from Waterford, Pennsylvania. You're on the air, Dolores.
Hi, Meghna. This whole situation has me, I can barely speak about it. But Flynn is a general. He's not a private. He was commissioned a second lieutenant. He was branched military intelligence. He would have been required to fill out at that time. I think the form has changed. It would have been a DD form 3908, which was a request for personnel security investigation. He would have had to have access to top secret, access to top secret with access to special compartmented information. Now, he would have been sent to Fort Huachuca, Arizona, which is the home of the U.S. Army Intelligence Center and School. He would have had to fill out so he had knowledge of how to fill out the form. And it was also been a part of his training, his officer basic course at Fort Huachuca, Arizona.
Dolores, can I just jump in here for a second? It sounds like you know a lot. Do you have?
I spent 20 years in military intelligence, and I am very familiar with this form. Now, Magna, if I could just bring out two more points.
Yeah, sorry to say this, Dolores, but if you could do it quickly, that'd be great because we've just got about a minute here.
Okay, now, first of all, that questionnaire asked if you have ever had any contact with any foreign governments. Okay, so he knew. And so he knows that lying to the FBI, okay, was a crime, because lying on that form was punishable, or you could be punished by imprisonment or a large fine. So he knew. This man is not a worthy example of others to follow. I am absolutely disgusted.
Well, Dolores, thank you so much for your call. Mark Fisher, let me turn back to you here. How many members or members of the military or in the intelligence community have you spoke to who echo the thoughts we just heard from a 20-year veteran of military intelligence that we had in our caller, Dolores?
Quite a few. And what Dolores says is exactly what has mystified many of the people around Flynn, many of them friends and allies of Flynn, and some of them people who warned him not to go down this road when he was going to Moscow to appear for RT, the Kremlin's propaganda arm, when he was putting himself in a position to be seated next to Vladimir Putin, when he took part in a standing ovation for Vladimir Putin. There were people very close to Michael Flynn who warned him, do not do this. This will look terrible. This is not in keeping with your own career, your own tradition. And yet he charged ahead. He felt that he had to do this. He had to try to win the Russians over as part of this larger fight against radical Islam.
Yeah. Well, Nicholas Schmidl, we've got about 30 seconds left here. I'm curious, where do you think this goes from here? The next sentencing hearing, or at least the next time Flynn will stand before a judge, is now March of next year. So where do you think this might go?
I don't think it really goes very far. I think part of the reason why the Flynn's attorneys asked yesterday for an extension was because the judge made it clear that he didn't feel comfortable issuing a sentence until he knew that all of the cooperation that Flynn was going to provide had been provided. And the prosecutors left the door open for Flynn's ongoing cooperation with another criminal case. So I don't think we hear much from Flynn over the course of the next few weeks as the details remain under seal. But nonetheless, It's probably not great. It's going to cause the president some angst.
Yeah, and of course, the big question is what he's already told the Mueller team. Well, Nicholas Schmidl, staff writer at The New Yorker, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post, my thanks goes to you as well.
Great to be with you.
And by the way, they've both done extensive reporting on Michael Flynn's career. I really recommend that you read it. We've got links to it at onpointradio.org. When we come back, we'll talk to the president of the NAACP about why he's calling for a boycott of Facebook. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Russia not only used its internet influence campaign to sway American opinion in the 2016 election, it specifically targeted African Americans in an effort to suppress turnout among Democratic voters. That's one of the major findings from two reports commissioned by the Senate Intelligence Committee, which were revealed this week. And it's also why the NAACP is calling for a boycott of Facebook. Now, you can join the conversation. What's your reaction to the news that Russia targeted African American voters? Will you log out of Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram? And more broadly, how can we tell the difference between standard, legitimate, homegrown political activism and agitation versus disinformation planted on social media platforms? Now, full disclosure here, I have a family member, my brother, who is a project manager at Facebook, and he worked on the company's election security team for this year's election. But joining me now from Atlanta, Georgia, is Derek Johnson. He's president of the NAACP. Mr. Johnson, thank you so much for joining us On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, tell us more. What was your reaction initially when you saw in these Senate Intelligence Committee reports that African Americans were being specifically targeted? I hear you there in the airport. That the African Americans were being specifically targeted by Russia in their disinformation campaign.
Well, you know, it's something that we had learned about early on. Our frustration has been that the company has not taken aggressive action to remedy the problem, so it's something that won't repeat itself in the future. In addition to that, we also learned that they had hired our outside public relations firm to target African-American groups who have been raising the issue around this problem. Those things coupled with our ongoing concern with the lack of diversity in the company, which is reflected in some of these decisions, are all things that were appalling to the NAACP. And as a result of that, we called for an action of logging out of Facebook on yesterday as a part of our action to respond to what we've heard.
Right. And so you're referring to the reporting from the New York Times, I believe, late last month that Facebook had hired an opposition research group to look into racial justice groups such as Color of Change, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was Color of Change and several others. And for African-Americans, we understand the impact of when a governmental entity or private corporations use their leverage to target African-Americans. We've seen this take place in the late 60s, 70s with COINTELPRO. There were several companies that have also done similar incidents. So for us, we were really taken aback when we learned of that, in addition to all the other problems. And one of the least reported realities that we are concerned about is some of the discriminatory practices the platforms are being used for in terms of marketing houses. Pending lawsuits to address that as well. So for the NAACP, we are seeking for Facebook to right-size its operation and be more sensitive to different communities that use the platform.
Mm. Now, I'm seeing here that Facebook has said that it's meeting with groups such as Color of Change. It's going to do an audit, a civil rights audit, essentially. But I wonder, is calling for a one-day logout of Facebook really going to be enough? Because, to be perfectly honest, this is a company that has a years-long habit of apologizing. You know, for every time that we find out that they have company practices that aren't in line with privacy, for example, Mark Zuckerberg will get up and apologize, but then not much changes. So how more is a one day boycott enough?
Well, I don't know. I won't say it's enough. Our goal was to raise the level around this conversation. We've also seen the pattern of deny and delay, and we want to place a greater sense of urgency for them to aggressively address and remedy some of the things that have been outlined.
So how, for just to be clear, because I'm a little unclear on the length of the log out, and I know that that's not your whole point, but are you asking for a one day, a 1 week? How long do you want people to say no to Facebook?
Well, for the NAACP organization, we're logging out for a week, and for those organizations and companies can do the same, that's what we are pursuing. For individuals, we ask for a one-day log out, and we also understand that everything won't be fixed overnight, so it's an escalation proposition for us. If the company don't take this serious, go beyond just meeting and doing reports, then we have to take next steps, however we define next steps.
Okay. So, Derek Johnson, stand by for just 1 second. Let me take a quick call here. Mary is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, there should not be a boycott of Facebook because we need Facebook for the 2020 election. Facebook is freedom of the press, and you shouldn't be stupid enough. As a black person, been here since 1619, been here since slavery, been lied to, as to go along with boycotting a thing that we need. If it wasn't for Facebook, Black Lives Matter wouldn't have existed. Me Too wouldn't have existed. No Women's March on Washington. Mm. It's an organization tool. Don't be dumb enough to believe everything you read. We're adults now, and we need Facebook.
Mary, can I just jump in here? I take your point, but part of the problem is, I mean, what we're seeing is that there's a specific targeting of African Americans and the sophistication by which, you know, the misinformation that's being sent from Russian operatives makes it hard to tell the difference between, as you're saying, the legitimate political protest groups that you're talking about versus out and out propaganda, misinformation coming from a foreign power.
Look, those were the Russians who did that. We are Americans, and we are in a fight for our lives, whether you're black, white, yellow, or red. We have our enemy out there, and we need our own source of getting our propaganda out there. So the boycott Facebook, to me, is silly.
All right. Well, Mary, thank you so much for your call. Derek Johnson, before I have to let you go here, respond to Mary.
But, you know, we understand and appreciate the power of the tool of Facebook. And by no means we are trying to diminish that power. What we are saying is there is a corporate responsibility to ensure that the integrity of the platform is not used by foreign outside influences. It is not used to promote racial hatred and intolerance. And it's definitely not used to subvert democracy through attempts to suppress African-American voting patterns. Mm. So we're not saying not use it for the tool it could be used for. We're saying as a corporate culture, they need to put in the proper protection so it's not used to subvert our way of life.
Right. And have you personally heard from Facebook in response to what you're calling for?
Yeah, we have. We have met with Sheryl Sandberg, like many other African-American and other civil rights groups. And I think that's a good step. But, you know, for us, it's the actions, the implementation of the plan, and the priority they place on the recommendations coming from the civil rights audit is most important. So conversations are good. Outcomes are better.
Right. Well, Derek Johnson, president of the NAACP, joining us today from Atlanta at the airport there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a good morning.
All right. Well, let's turn now to Renee DiResta. She's the director of research at the cybersecurity company New Knowledge. She co-authored one of the reports on Russia's influence campaign for the Senate Intelligence Committee. There's a link to that at onpointradio.org. Renee, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So can you tell us in more detail, specifically, what is it that you found regarding how Russia was targeting, through these social media platforms, African-American voters?
Yeah, so we found a multi-year influence operation. It wasn't necessarily focused on the political, though that was, of course, a part of it. They created a number of pages, I believe it was 88, I think, on Facebook and 133 on Instagram. And those were segmented across various facets of U.S. society, including on Facebook, I believe, 30 pages targeting the African-American community. They were not monolithic. They actually went really deeply. Each one had a different kind of facet of a particular type of culture. So there was a black liberation theology page. There was a Baptist-focused page. There was a couple of Black Lives Matter-type focused pages, much more political. There were a couple of culture-focused pages, things about beauty and hair and pride and culture. And so they weren't kind of uniformly generic. They were actually extremely well segmented to appeal to different facets of the black experience.
Well, do we know how many people saw them?
We know that the content overall was engaged with about 78 million times on Facebook, individual engagements, on like leaving comments and things like that. And Facebook has speculated that 120 million people saw the content on Facebook and another 20 million saw it on Instagram.
As a whole, not specifically the African American targeted content.
I don't have that number off the top of my head, unfortunately.
Okay, but nevertheless, by definition, how these social networks work is, you know, it takes a few number of posts to be significantly amplified through a social network. So we can presume that perhaps, you know, many people did see them. Now,
yeah. So the pages had probably 300,000 to 500,000 followers or so for some of the top, the most successful, from their point of view, black pages had about 300,000 to 500,000 followers.
Okay. Now, and you said that some of it was not necessarily directly political content. I mean, what's the difference between that and there were messages that were following news stories or mimicking, grievances that African Americans already had for, say, things like policing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there was a lot of focus on policing. There was a lot of focus on police brutality and violence on some of the pages. But there were other pages that really focused more on culture. There was a lot of actually cross-promotion of black businesses. So they reached out to black businesses and appear to have run promos for them. sort of, you know, they would sort of, the narrative of just being extremely pro-black business, it was a lot of, like, hair care products, a lot of skin care products that were designed specifically for black women. So some of the pages were really designed more to be, like, kind of cultural commentary, just pride. The way that they did it was they created really strong in-group dynamics. So across all of the pages, the LGBT page was also particularly strong on this, where the vast majority of the posts were about pride, pride in culture, pride in heritage, pride in sexual orientation. And then what they would do is they would add a political post in there. So it would establish kind of an in-group dynamic, like, we are African-American people, this is our culture. And then there would be these posts that would say, like, as black people, we can't vote for Hillary Clinton. As black people, we should be supporting Jill Stein. As black people, we shouldn't vote because our country, this isn't our country. And so it was always, it was never framed as, like, a prescriptive thing. It was framed as, like, because we are members of this group, we know that we shouldn't do this.
Right.
And that was how, so much more like creating and reinforcing an in-group dynamic. The divisiveness came when they would, similarly, particularly on some of the far-right pages, it would be, we are Americans, and so we should not, you know, we have no obligation to deal with these refugees. Mm. We don't want these immigrants. So it was very, that they did that same kind of creation of in-group dynamics across all of their pages.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Renee, hang on here for just a second, because I want to get at least one or two calls in before we run out of time. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Toronto, Canada. Michael, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. My opinion is that we might be overthinking this. In its most simplistic terms, Russia wanted Trump to be elected. In order to do that, they needed to influence people to either vote for him or not vote at all. And because African Americans are easily identified and proven to be Democratic voters, it seems like a relatively easy group to target. And I don't think they were targeted because they're African Americans as much as I think they were targeted because they are 90% plus Democratic voters. And I think that is probably the rationale that all of this targeting boils down to.
Yeah.
I don't think it has to do with their culture as much as it has to do with the fact that they vote as a monolithic block.
Michael, thank you so much for your call. Let's go quickly to Robert, who's calling from Raysville, Georgia. Robert, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. And I enjoy you very much every day.
Thank you. What's your thought for today?
I think that it's an insult to the African Americans they're intelligent enough to have Facebook. They're intelligent enough to graduate from high school, go to college, and I just think it's an insult to them to think that some Russian bullcrap could influence them in any way.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for your call. And I just have to say, I mean, we feel like we've had story after story about how Russia had, and you know, its efforts to influence American divisions and American politics. Obviously, Russia thought that it would have an influence not just on African Americans, but American voters at large over many months and even years, as Renee D'Resta is telling us. But thank you so much for your call. Renee, we just got a minute and a half left here to go. And I want to get your response on one thing about how Facebook, you know, says Sheryl Sandberg put up a Facebook post, saying that the company is taking the findings of your report, quote, incredibly seriously, and that they're going to work to strengthen and advance civil rights on our service. We know that we need to do more. This is language that Facebook uses repeatedly every time we have yet another report or story coming out about fundamental problems with this platform that now reaches 2 billion people around the world. I mean, they know they need to do more, but it doesn't seem like they are doing enough. I mean, have you been impressed or not with Facebook's response so far, and what should they be doing?
Well, you mentioned you had a family member on the election integrity team. I think that the election integrity team, you know, I did some work and some communication with them in 2018. They did it was a remarkable turnaround. They really did make a concerted effort to be absolutely on point, to work with researchers, and I think that they deserve commendation for that. More generally speaking, I do think that at this point, the regulations approach is going to be where we need to go. I think that we have seen that self-regulation just doesn't work on its own in this industry.
Well, so then hopefully the Senate Intelligence Committee reports that you've done is a step in getting Washington to perhaps do that, to go down the road for regulation on social media. We'll see what happens. Renee DiResta, Director of Research at the cybersecurity company New Knowledge. She co-authored a report on Russia's influence campaign on social media, did that for the Senate Intelligence Committee. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Alina Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder, with help from David Marino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.